Welcome to the Reformed French. We got two Reformed Baptist pastors who are excited about all things scripture, including the fringe side of our Bibles, which we tend to ignore, which we would say the supernatural parts of our Bible. Our goal for this podcast is to put the fringe back into the Reformed and help the fringe be a little bit more Reformed. And we did an episode about that recently on the fringy side of free will and predestination. And hopefully you heard a gracious explanation of why we think free will and predestination is an important conversation, why it's a supernatural conversation. If you'd like to learn more about the host, you could do so by going to reformfringe.com. Your hosts are Doug Van Dorn, who's the pastor of the Reformed Baptist Church in Northern Colorado. And I'm John Moffitt. I'm the pastor of Grace Reformed Church in Spring Hill, Tennessee. Doug, there's a lot of information that's been flying around, lots of good stuff happening. Probably the best place for you to go learn about myself and Doug is reformfringe.com. You and I just did a live members-only show there. First one, or I guess not first one, but first one I've done in a while. Critiquing, thinking through some articles that have been recently written. We'll get around to that later. But it was about an hour conversation, just giving our thoughts, not scripted. We read an article and kind of just gave our thoughts on some confusion about Elohim and the gods. So you can go over to the Reformed Fringe and learn more about that there. Doug, now the internet has been abuzz for a while now, and you and I have decided to jump into the fray and write on it. You've already written on it for years. Your Giants book, Angel of the Lord book, even the book you did on conspiracy kind of relates to this. But there's a little bit more of a nuance, not so much us arguing about giants and the divine council, but more specifically on how the word Elohim can be used and the accusation of monotheism. Are you a monotheist if you believe that the other gods that are lesser gods, that are not Yahweh, that are created, if you believe that they are real entities, are you no longer a monotheist? Are you a polytheist, or are you a henotheist? And so that's where this conversation kind of picked up. You and I have written multiple articles. We're going to talk about one of the articles you wrote today, really important as it relates to how the word Elohim and Theos and God are used etymologically. Can I say that correctly?
Yeah. Yep.
And so we're going to go through this. This is a nerdy conversation. I'll say this up front, but let me tell you what. It is so important. It's so important to the conversation of understanding your Bible. Like, if you don't understand how words are used, then you're going to misinterpret them all of the time. And so this conversation is important because we're going to talk about how words are used, and then that'll help us properly understand the text. And so we're going to deal with, if you want to learn more about this, you can go to the two places this is at. It's at thereformfriends.com inside our membership there, or you can go to douglasvandorn.com. Or you can go to the show notes, and we'll put the link to the article there. The article is called "Gods versus God: Unmasking the Semantic Showdown in Biblical Monotheism." By the way, super cool graphic. I was impressed.
You like that one?
I do like that one.
It's better than mine so far.
Welcome, Doug. I've done a lot of talking. Oh, before I forget, it's coming close. Coming very close. You and I are going to be together in South Nashville, town of Spring Hill, in my church, Grace Reformed Church. And we're going to be hosting a one-day gathering, get-together. We're going to be discussing this type of stuff, and more specifically, how we're going to be talking more about how Reformed theology is seeing a resurgence in the supernatural. And so we're going to do a couple of lectures on it, podcast, Q&A, and a dinner together, or a lunch together. So you can learn more about that at the Fringe, enough money to help us cover cleaning and food. So if you can't afford it, come anyways. We'd love to have you here. That's October 30th. You can learn more at our website. Okay. Enough with the announcements. Let's jump into this article because we have a lot to cover.
Yeah. So we want to talk about, as you brought up, the etymology of the word God. Etymology just means where it came from. How did we get how do we get this word? You know, why did they start using this word to refer to this thing? And etymologies can be very helpful because they can give you an insight into the earliest origins and usages of words. When people coin words today, probably my favorite theologian that does that is Meredith Klein. Mm-hmm. And his very first page of his book on Harmageddon, I think he coins like 15 words. it becomes impossible to read. But you can, if you understand the Greek and the Latin and the English roots, you go, okay, now I understand why he coined that word, because that's what you do, right? When you make words that you haven't found a good word that fits with your idea. So that's what's going on when you introduce a word into a language. So this article started, John, because there's a series of articles that have been put out, and now we're up to the third one by a pastor and a doctor named Drew Grumbles. Mm-hmm. And we can link to those articles if people want as well. And in that article, he is trying to make the case that Elohim only means one thing. Elohim is the Hebrew word, by the way, that we translate always and everywhere in every English Bible that I've ever seen with the word God, English word God, or the English word gods. But we just saying that doesn't tell you what it means. And unfortunately, in his series, he's really presupposing a definition for a word that he's never actually proved only means that. Mm-hmm. The definition that he's presupposing is for Elohim is what we refer to in English, in modern English, with a capital G-O-D, the word God, you know, that whenever you read that, unless it's the first word in a sentence, you know exactly who it's talking about. It's talking about the Christian God. And so what's happened is people have taken a certain definition of those three letters that we capitalize, and they've imposed backwards on it that this is what the word means and has always meant, and that there's only one definition of it, which is funny to me. When you go to a dictionary, you will find multiple definitions for almost every word in the dictionary. But for some reason, the word God is not allowed to have any other definition except for something like the uncreated, unique being that there are none others like, right? Mm-hmm. That's basically what those three word letters G-O-D mean to a lot of people. And so what I thought would be interesting to do would be to go and look at the etymologies of four different words, one in Hebrew, one in Greek, one in Latin, one in English. And what you find is super interesting, because in none of these cases do these words actually derive from anything having to do with essence or being or nature. They all derive from function or something that an entity does. That right there says a lot in my mind about this idea that the letters G-O-D can only refer to an ontological category of what it means to be something in its essence. In fact, that idea completely is obliterated by all four etymologies of these words. So let's dive into it. The first word is the word Elohim. This word comes from a Semitic or ancient Near Eastern root word for power or might. And that word would be El, and Eloah is another form of anything that starts with the letters in English, E-L, in the way that we transliterate it into the Hebrew into English. El has the word power or might associated with its root meaning. Okay, so this word is found in Genesis 1:1 of God. In the beginning, Elohim created. Well, it's interesting that it would choose Elohim there, because the verb that's associated with it is create. So that's an idea of power, okay? God created other entities, though. For example, in Psalm 8:5, that he made man a little lower than. Dr. Gonzalez pointed out to me that somebody has recently made an article that says that the making of men lower than the Elohim was actually attributed to the fall and not to creation, which is a very interesting idea. But nevertheless, the point is that it's attributing the word Elohim to some kind of an entity that is higher than humans, but lower than God, who is also called an Elohim. Okay, so that's really interesting that you have God who no Christian denies has what we call incommunicable attributes. So an incommunicable attribute would be something like omnipotence. Omnipotence means all power. He can do whatever he wants all the time. Nothing can stop him. Nothing can stay his hand. There are communicable attributes that are, though, parallel to this or analogical to this. So power would be a communicable attribute. Omnipotence is all power. That's incommunicable because only one being can have that. Power is communicable and it can be given to all kinds of creatures. Humans have power of a certain kind. Angels have power of a certain kind. The reason I'm bringing that word up is because that's the root word for Elohim, is the word power or might. And so here's the key to this. Elohim does not mean omnipotent. Mm-hmm. It means power. It's not an incommunicable attribute that only one entity possesses. It's a communicable attribute that all kinds of entities could possess. But this is never brought up and never discussed. And it's like, you're not even allowed to have a conversation about this. But when you do, suddenly you go, okay, well, now wait a minute. That might imply then that if you have God in view, the being we call God, the creator, that he might have one set of attributes when it comes to what that word means. But when you have other entities that are called that, it might mean that they have a different set of attributes that they share with him in a communicable sense, but not in an incommunicable sense. When you presuppose that the word God must mean omnipotence, then you can't, by definition, have any other entity that would be an Elohim, right?
Right.
But if the word has a semantic range and it can mean more than one thing, it can include omnipotence and power, then suddenly, well, guess what? You're opened up to the idea that you could have other entities that are rightly, properly called Elohim, because they're sharing in something that those entities can actually have by their nature, because God created them to have power.
That's right.
Not all power, not omnipotence, but power.
Yeah. We were mentioning this earlier. I'll mention it here now in the other show that we did about how, and this is not an exact one-to-one, but I think the illustration works. Jesus, who is God, is human. Right. So it says he lowered himself and he took on human flesh. Therefore, you and I have something in common with Jesus.
Which is humanness.
Is humanness.
Yeah, exactly.
But we in no sense whatsoever could say that we are God. Or what we mean by that, Jesus, right?
We're he not is Jesus, unique. Yeah. Yeah.
That's right. And in many ways, Jesus becoming an incarnate, like he took on our flesh, but that means that we have something in common with him. So therefore, we can hold the title human, and Jesus can hold the title human, and yet Jesus is not just human. Jesus is more than human, but he is human. And this is true of Elohim, and this is the argument that's being made for many, many years now, is that there is something in common with Elohim that are created and Elohim that is not. There's something that is in common, but that does not mean there's an equality. It just means there's a commonality. And that's the thing where I know that that creates there's a concern that you're trying to make equal powers. There's a difference between commonality. In other words, my wife and I have a commonality, Doug. We're both humans, but we're very, very different. She can never be a male and I'll never be a female. And this is where we would say that Elohim are created. There's communicable attributes. There are things that are in common with them, with Yahweh. But that does not mean that they are one in the same.
Yeah. Let me give an example of this. Just kind of popped in my head. Isaiah 46 and verses 9 and 10. So it says, remember the former things of old, for I am Elohim. There is no other. I am Elohim. There is none like me. Now, that's interesting right there, because you could just take the first one and go, there is no other, and say, okay, no other Elohim exists. Because see, it says there are no other. But the very next line in the poetry says, I am Elohim. There is none like me. And then the next words say, explain how. It says, declaring the end from the beginning and from ancient times, things not yet done, saying, my counsel shall stand and I will accomplish all my purpose. So what does this mean? It means that when the word Elohim is used in those two verses, it presupposes that there are other Elohim, not that there aren't, but that there are, and then it distinguishes the Elohim as being omnipotent and omniscient by actually stating that, right?
Right.
I declare the end from the beginning and nothing can, I will do all I want. I can accomplish all my purpose. I know everything. I can do everything. And there is no other Elohim that is like that. That doesn't mean they don't have power. That doesn't mean they don't have knowledge. It means they don't have all power and all knowledge. And it's not the word itself that tells you that. It's the context that tells you that. And this happens almost every time the Bible is giving some kind of a comparative illustration. It's telling you, I'm the only holy God. I'm the only God who sees. I'm the only wise God in terms of having that level of infinite wisdom, infinite holiness, infinite power. Nothing else is like that, but it doesn't mean other Elohim don't exist. And the only way that you can see that is if you allow for the fact that the etymology of the word tells you that there actually are entities that have these communicable attributes that really do exist, and that's what they are by nature.
Can I, you know, I haven't put this in writing, but I need to. When it says he is the God of gods, they're like, yeah, but they're not real. And he is the King of kings. Are you going to say they're not real?
The kings aren't real. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it doesn't work. It's he is the God of gods. He is the King of kings. He is the Lord of lords. Are the lords not real? The rulers are not real. Again, this, it's weird that we will say one is not in existence. And yet this is used multiple times in scripture, not just once. Like even Paul says, for there are many gods and many lords. And people are like, well, the gods aren't real. And it's like, are you going to say the lords aren't real either? I mean, it's really strange how this is used. And so as an example, we have to step back and say, if he's making a comparison, he is of something. It makes zero sense to say he's over something of nothing. You know,
or even over something that he calls the same thing, but they're really not that. They're something.
Right. Right.
So a king isn't really a king because God's the only king, and a Lord isn't really a Lord. He's because only God is the Lord. No, we distinguish even those two words with a capital letter, capital L, capital K, and put them next to lowercase L, lowercase K, lowercase D.
Right.
All right, let's move on. We can do these a little bit more quickly because we've kind of established the whole point of doing an etymology and this communicable attribute idea. That's the most important part of this, I think, that what we're saying is that God is unlike the gods, not in that they don't exist, but in that he alone has attributes the way he possesses them. But he shares attributes that are shareable with his creation if he wants to communicate those to them when he creates them. So the second word is the word theos. This is now the Greek word that I wanted to look into. Theos always translates Elohim in the Septuagint. And it's also the word that's always used for God in the New Testament. So,
right. Just for those that this might be your first show.
Yeah.
Septuagint is the Greek translation of the Old Testament.
Yeah. So they translated the Hebrew in around the second century BC into the Greek language because most of the Jews stopped speaking Hebrew and they didn't understand it. So they needed a translation of their own book, just like we don't speak Middle English anymore. So we needed Wycliffe to be slightly updated.
Or we don't speak Latin anymore.
Exactly. So what does the word theos mean? If this is the word that they always use to translate Elohim, well, does it mean the entity that alone possesses only these attributes, or does it mean something else? Well, this comes from a Proto-Indo-European word that means sacred or shining. Well, that's interesting. There are lots of things that are sacred in this world. There are lots of entities that shine. I mean, we even say this about women when they're pregnant. Oh, you're shining, right? You're glowing. Okay. Whenever you see an angel in the Bible, oftentimes it'll say that I saw this being and it was shining and it was so glorious that I wanted to fall down worshiping. And it said, don't worship me, worship God. Yet it's still shone.
Right. And even the stars, when it talks about the stars and the sun and the Old Testament.
Stars, yeah. I mean, something that's sacred or shining. Mm-hmm. Well, that's not ontology. That's not that in terms of a unique attribute that only God possesses. Rather, it's a communicable, functional attribute that is something that's possessed by lesser entities than God himself. In other words, by the creation. Mm-hmm. In particular, it's possessed by, I would say, angelic beings. Okay, so why would you use shining or sacred to translate a word that means power? Hmm. Pretty interesting. But nevertheless, that's what they did. How about a third word? This is the Latin word for God. So every time that the Latin Vulgate translates the Hebrew or the Greek, so the Hebrew Elohim or the Greek Theos, it uses the word Deus. Now this one's different still. It's come from the word Devos, meaning sky. So Deus doesn't mean incommunicable attributes of nature that only one entity possesses. It simply means a sky. So it's a sky god. Well, guess where the angels always come from in the Bible?
Mm-hmm. The sky.
Right. And guess where the gods are said to reside on Mount Olympus? They mm-hmm. actually don't reside on the mountain. They reside over it in the sky. So why wouldn't you use a word like sky to translate, you know, you could ask, but why wouldn't they? And you could also ask, why would they? Right. Mm-hmm. Both questions are very interesting. What you find, though, is that none of these are etymologically derived from the word, from an idea that means only one entity in all the universe possesses this. Mm-hmm. They're all communicable. Maybe the most interesting one to me is actually our word God.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Because this is the one that causes the most troubles for us since we speak English. So where does that come from? So there's two ideas when you go to the etymological dictionaries. The first one is that it comes from a Germanic, an early Proto-Germanic word, guda, meaning to invoke. So a god is simply something that is invoked. Well, guess what? You can invoke all kinds of things. Ask witches. They invoke all kinds of evil things all the time.
Mm-hmm.
God is not the only entity that can be invoked and do something for you.
Right.
That's important. It's not an incommunicable attribute to be invoked. The other right. idea is that it comes from another Indo-European word, gutu, meaning poured, as in a libation, as in something that you pour a libation, a drink offering to in a worship service. Again, if you know anything about Satanism, they do this with Satan all the time with blood.
Mm-hmm.
They're invoked. They pour out. They worship them. Now, the word itself, God, G-O-D, does not say that you should or shouldn't do that to an entity. That's not its purpose. It's simply saying that this is an entity that people did this to. And the reason why they did it too is because they were powerful. They came from the sky. They were, what are the other ones? Shining sacred creatures in their mythologies. And so they therefore invoked them. So Thor and Odin and Ostra and Suna and Freya, all these entities that are in kind of the Northern European world where we get our English from, they were all invoked. And they were all entities that the peoples called gods. In our earliest English lexicons, not because they didn't exist and not because they didn't have that, not because they have that title wrongly attributed to them because only one entity can be God, but rather the exact opposite, because lots of entities could be invoked. Lots of them can be worshiped. Lots of them come from the sky. They share those attributes with God. In other words, these words, all four of them that we translate as God, none of them have as their root an incommunicable, I'm sorry to keep saying this, John, but it just needs to be said over and over.
I don't have to stop.
Drumbeat to get it in people's heads. None of them mean what we have come to define it to mean when we capitalize the word. Now that, now that said, it's not wrong to have a word change definitions, right? So it's not wrong that we capitalize a word. And then when we think of the capital letter G, O, D, that we have in our mind one and only one entity that exists. That's not wrong. It's just the way language works. Language evolves. But that wasn't originally how it was used. And it's not okay to import a meaning that it never had, because we have it in the 21st century upon people writing 3,000 years ago and expect that they have the same definition that we do. They have belief in the same God that we do, but they went about describing him not with a capital G, but with sentences that tell you who he is.
That's right. Yeah, that's right. That's like, you know, if I just say my dad, but you've never met my dad, you have no idea who he is. Or I say a dad or a father, you're like, well, what father are we talking about? You know, we're talking about your father, my father, a father. What are we talking about? And this is what they would say things. Yahweh, our God, right? This is why they say things in the Old Testament, Doug, like the God of the Canaanites, the God of the Hittites, right? Why? Because those were possessive gods that were part of those people. So obviously this is a book about Israel's Genesis and their story of their Messiah. And so often it will refer to them as God. They don't have to define it until it gets into a place where you're talking about a multiplicity of gods. And then they will say, Yahweh, our God, who is the God of gods, who was so separate from any other gods. And this is where it is interesting how words form and shape and they just change over time. And I'm with you. I don't have a problem with certain words changing over time, even if we're maybe correcting them to make them more accurate. I think that video, What is a Woman? Have you seen that?
Right.
The documentary?
Right.
Dude, you talk about absolute insanity in our American system where people can't define the word woman. They can't do it. And that's where I'm like, listen, I'm not equating our brothers to be insane or that they're liberal or dirty or any of those kind of things. That's not what I'm saying at all. But words have morphed and changed over time because of cultural pressures. And I think that cultural pressure is a lot to do with rationalism and anti-supernaturalism, to where the word has now become something that it was not originally. It's not, its original intent wasn't describing it to be that way. And I think this was, but this happens a lot in our, I mean, here's a great one that's not as offensive. The word awful. That is awful. What was the original meaning of that word, Doug?
Yeah, we actually have that word in one of our hymns in the Trinity hymnal. And people, the first time they read that, sing that, they're like, oh, I just said God is awful. But
it's awful.
A great word, right? Because when you use the compound, you see where it came from. Full of awe.
Full of awe.
But the same that, you know, slang usually does is it will take a good word and it will corrupt it and switch it exactly the opposite. So now, you know, a great example of that is the word bad. Oh, she's really bad. But what you really mean is she's good, because slang twists and perverts language. That's what it does.
Oh, that is sick.
That's sick. And we do this with all kinds of words, right?
That's so cool. You know, my favorite one is I'm anxious.
Do you know why we capitalize the word God? This is really interesting. So if you go back and you read, like, say, your 1500s and 1600s English in the original text, you can go back to some of these old books on Google. Mm-hmm. What you'll see is there's all kinds of nouns in a sentence that are capitalized, all kinds of them. And that we don't capitalize today.
Right.
Why did they do that? Well, so they had just invented the printing press. And so now they have this thing called language that they can now put everywhere. And so If you don't have like boldface type or italics or underlines or whatever, how could you emphasize a word? Capitalize it. So they start capitalizing all kinds of nouns. Over the course of time, through people like Noah Webster, who did, you know, his famous 1828 dictionary, you started to get the kind of a refinement of how they would do their capitalization. And then when you get even more modern with modern typewriters, where they could actually go back and double strike and triple strike a letter and a word, you could have bolds. So now you're getting very different ways of marking text. And so what happened was that the capitalization of all these nouns became obsolete. You didn't need to do it because you had other ways of emphasizing a word. So what happened was that capitalization came to mean one particular kind of a word in the English language, other than the first word of a sentence, right? And what is that word? Proper name.
That's right.
So I capitalize Doug. You capitalize John.
John.
Yeah. We capitalize God. Because what happened was it becomes a very easy convention to convey in one capitalization, something you didn't used to be able to do because you capitalize every other word. You capitalize God, and now you can convey in that one capitalization an entire paragraph that it takes in your confession of faith to tell you who he is.
Which is helpful.
Really genius and really cool. And so then when you keep the lowercase g, then you know that that's not the same thing, even though it's the same three letters.
Yeah. Also, and most people probably know this, in case you don't know, capital Lord with just the L is different than all caps L-O-R-D. All caps L-O-R-D is in reference to Yahweh.
I wish they wouldn't do that. That's a convention that I hate. I wish they would just give us Yahweh. Give us Adonai. Let us pretend that we're not that stupid and we can actually learn transliterated words.
You think it's some of that weird fear, of like using the actual, you know,
the word, the name or something like that? Yeah, maybe. I don't know.
The Jewish suspicion that was brought over. Maybe that was brought over. Because even Adonai is not even a real word.
Right. It's a compound of Jehovah and Yahweh.
Every time I see when someone says Adonai, and I was like, don't do that.
Yeah.
It's a made up.
Oh my goodness.
It's like the word Lucifer. It's totally made up. It's like people don't understand Lucifer is not Satan's name. Hey, by the way, that's an example of how a word can change over time, even in scripture. Satan, right? The Satan eventually becomes a description of, because Satan means adversary, the adversary becomes his official title. He is
all
adversary.
Of these are this way, John. This is really interesting because angels are this way.
Yeah.
It used to be a function, a messenger. Then all of a sudden it becomes capitalized. Demons are this way. They were creatures that were knowing ones. There's like four different derivations of daemon. They're not quite sure where it comes from, but that's probably my favorite one. Ones that know. But now it becomes an evil entity. Satan, devil, is the same way. A slanderer. You got women that are called devils in the New Testament.
Well, Jesus is called Satan. Devil. Or God is called Satan.
God is called Satan. And the angel of the Lord is called the Satan, the adversary. Mm-hmm. How interesting that it's all these supernatural words about supernatural entities that originally were, all of them were functional, that we somehow, for some reason, over the course of the language, changed to become descriptors of certain types of entities.
Mm-hmm. Because someone said to me, and this is kind of like a side podcast, so we can end it here because it doesn't need to be super long, but someone said to me, why don't you guys just like call them angels and everybody will leave you alone? Like, well, imagine trying to describe, like, imagine we get rid of hard mail. Like, there's no more mail. We don't do mail anymore. You don't get delivery of mail. Okay. It's all digital. And eventually it's probably coming, Doug, because guess what? My kids have never heard in their life a dial tone. They've never picked up the phone and had to hit buttons. That's a funny story.
Are you telling me that they're going to take away my AOL address?
Maybe. Funny story, I was at a hotel with my daughter and I said, hey, pick up that phone and hit the button that says front desk and ask them for some more sheets. And so, and then I found them. I was like, that's okay, just hang up. And she's holding it and I can hear it ringing. I said, baby, you can just hang up. And I said, Jane, hang up the phone. And she goes, Dad, I can't find the hang up button. I took the phone out of her hand and I put it down. I was like, that's how you hang up a phone. Word. Like, they have never had the satisfaction in the 90s of slamming a phone down when you're done with a conversation. Okay. Yeah. But that being said, when you're trying to describe later on in humanity and you're like, well, all humans are mailmen. And that's what you just don't call them humans because then they can sound like Jesus. And Jesus is human. So we're just going to call him mailman. And it's like, well, that's not technically, I mean, mailmen were humans who delivered things.
I love that.
Yeah, they delivered things. But that's not the encompassment of what, no, they're humans who had lots of jobs. Not all humans were mailmen. I mean, a lot of them delivered. Sure, at one point in the day, you deliver a message, but that doesn't technically make you a mailman. And this is what we're doing in the Bible. And I'm kind of like, I understand why, because you don't want to be culturally offensive and cause confusion, but I think the confusion's already there and we need to do some correcting here.
And I would say even more than that, that when you actually are trying to help people understand the richness of the language, mm-hmm. you actually increase and enlarge their worldview and allow them to see things that they could never see before. A good example, my good buddies over at Laborie Creatures, they've been commenting more and more, especially when they do a creature show, on how when they first started the podcast, they were like, well, I had no idea how rich the supernatural realm was in terms of different kinds of creatures, because all we're ever taught is that there's good angels and fallen angels, the angels and the demons, and that's it. Mm-hmm. And when you realize that there's a host of heaven, and that they're given all kinds of titles and names, and that they don't all do the same thing. They don't have the different same function. They don't have the same rank. All of a sudden, wow, it becomes a lot like thinking about Earth and how complicated Earth is and how intricate it is that God made. And heaven is how much bigger than Earth? I don't know. Almost infinitely bigger than Earth. Not quite. But how far can you see into the universe? I don't know. A long way.
That quote by Spurgeon, how many other planets are there? He goes, I don't know, millions. Inhabited planets. Have you seen this quote?
That's funny that he would say something like that long ago.
I know. When I read that, I was like, first of all, I want to know if that's Grok making up a quote about him. And secondly, because that happens, man. Let me tell you what. Hey, important conversation. Look, I think the way I would want to close this down is, does Doug's paper, is it the trump card? It's like, see, we're right. No, but it really
a trump card.
No,
just meant to be something that asks a question of what is the word? Where did the words originate? And does that have anything to add to our conversation when we're talking about different Elohim? And I think that it brings a lot to the table that has not been discussed before.
Yeah, I completely agree. And a lot of this happens. Nephilim, giant, demons, all of these things get convoluted and get messed up. And then it actually becomes harder to understand what God is trying to tell us as his people. This isn't just a fun history book. This is a sacred book. Therefore, it means more to us to get it right than it does to just assume we got it right. So, all right, that's it for now. We're going to talk about another article that I wrote. So you'll have to come back for that one. If you want to learn more about these, you can go to both of our websites and you can learn more about that at reformfringe.com. So we'll just close it there, Doug.
See you, everyone. Thanks for listening to The Fringe.